Tax Day has come and gone, and we're in the midst of Money Smart Week, a federal effort to get people to be more aware of their personal finances. Since money's on our minds, we gave financial counselor Connie Kilmark a call.
In addition to the dollars and cents, Connie focuses on the relationship we have with our money and our possessions, the emotional impact our finances can have on our lives, and how it all affects our personal relationships. Today, she'll tell us about our financial personalities and how couples and families can share the work and the information surrounding their finances.
Connie Kilmark is a financial counselor and founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark & Associates. Connie, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Connie, you say that it's important to know our financial personality, what our personality is like when it comes to money, and how it affects money together. How does that all work together as a complete package?
Well, when you think about it, financial personality is really a composite. It's made up sort of at the intersection of things like family history, historical period in which you came of age, peer culture and experiences both in your neighborhood and in your school cultures, but continuing even in adult work culture. And then there's a huge portion of it that's composed of what we're calling these days the neurobiology of the way we think about value propositions. You know, what is something worth and how much knowledge do I need before I can make a decision, how quickly I can make a decision. So when you have something as complex as that and you have something as irrational as love, can you imagine how unlikely it is that we're going to end up in a love relationship with somebody who is the perfect, suitable partner for us financially? It's just so unlikely. So we're going to be bridging differences in our couples' relationships.
Well, let's go into couples for a bit. As we said, it's just been tax time, and some couples maybe sat down together and did their taxes. Many probably didn't. What kind of division of labor do you see working with couples when it comes to money, and how do they divvy up those responsibilities?
Well, I want to say first a shout out for taxes are not a bad thing. Tax is a good thing. It's a subscription fee that we pay together to do certain things together that are just much more affordable when we do them together. So let's just get that out of the way. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to minimize the legal burden that you have, but I actually think tax is a great idea. I think the idea of doing your taxes together, first of all, in most couple relationships, there's going to be a significant amount of division of labor. There's going to be, I'll do this if you do that. I'll do the outside chores, you do the inside chores, those kinds of things. So most likely, there's going to be some way in which one partner is more habituated to and expert at thinking about the task of the money, especially after you've been a couple for a while. If, in fact, you're a new couple, it's a great idea to at least gather the information for the preparation together so that at least you know the components that go into the tax picture. But remember, even if both of you do it together, the tax side of things is only a compilation of income and the taxes you owe. It leaves almost completely out significant amount of really important granular detail about what you're spending your money on, and can often evoke a tremendous argument that starts like this. Well, if we're making this much money, where is it going?
Yeah.
So be careful if you've been into this for a long time and all of a sudden somebody is entering the discussion because you want both partners to be pulling together, and that's the only side of it that they're seeing, because that can really be quite electric.
Right. What are the downsides when you do have a division of labor like that? One person has more of affinity, say, with the financial aspect, and it makes sense just for the sake of efficiency to have that person do the lion's share of the financial work. But what are the downsides when that happens and when the other person isn't totally plugged into the big financial picture?
Well, you don't have to actually do all the administrative work to be more plugged in than the kind of partnership you're describing, where one person is the spreadsheet brain and the other person just says, well, he's better or she's better at it. And by the way, this is an equal gender opportunity kind of mindset. Some women and some men are quite analytical and quite spreadsheety. And those are people who are likely to have quite a high tolerance for the sorts of task that tax preparation is. But I think that the idea that the downside is that there's got to be ironclad trust. There's often a sense of, why do I have to do this and why don't you understand? And a tremendous kind of growing ignorance on the part of the person who isn't involved in the task, so that over year after year after year, that person really ends up in a tremendously information deficit position. So I think that it's valuable when making the decisions that flow out of that information sharing that both people at least have some grounding in it, even if they're not both completely doing the granular task.
Well, and Connie, I think we've probably all known someone or had someone in our family in the situation of a spouse passes away or there's a divorce, and now if you're the person who wasn't on the finances, you're starting in a hole and trying to dig yourself out of it, trying to understand what the heck's going on.
Exactly. So there ought to be some familiarity. There ought to be someone lined up if there is a severe division of labor. The person who's been doing it, and I'm talking about couples of goodwill now, not couples who are really trying to snipe at each other and who actually have poor bad will, but in couples of goodwill, if there's been a long-standing pattern where one person has done the task, there ought to be a coach lined up in advance of that person's illness or passing, so that you're thinking as you age, okay, who is going to be able to coach or kind of buddy my not-so-plugged-in partner when the time comes, and some of this will need to be explained, even if we can't get to it as a couple together.
We're talking right now with financial consultant Connie Kilmark about money, relationships, and emotions right now. And Connie, you said there should be some sort of coach. So would that person be a financial planner? I mean, I can see as far as taxes go, just thinking, well, I will have a tax preparer do this instead of myself, even though my partner did it. Is there anything wrong with that, with leaning heavily on somebody else?
Well, as long as the non-financially inclined spouse or partner starts doing that work early enough in the tax season. It's a not great idea ever to be a brand new beginner trying to assemble your tax picture and waiting until April 5th or 7th, because you'll want to use that first season. It's the first season without your partner, if whether it's a divorce or a death or a severe illness, you're going to want to use some time just to get up to speed and figure out what do I collect and why am I collecting it. And most tax preparers will send you an organizer so that you will have that opportunity. Please don't wait till the last minute, you know, just because it's a task you're unfamiliar with.
Well, Connie, can you give us an inventory, whether we're that, you know, the spouse who doesn't do the finances, or just, you know, an individual or maybe a kid emerging into adulthood? What are a few basics that we should try to get under our belt, get a grasp on?
Well, for one thing, especially when it comes to taxes, drop the notion that the typeface that the IRS uses is somehow going to electrify you if you look at it too long. There is such an amount of terror around the notion of managing your own taxes. I recently had the pleasure, and I will actually call it that in public, of doing my disabled daughter's tax return. I had not usually done that before. And I actually found it, I know I'm a little weird about this, I actually found it strangely pleasurable, because each line has instructions. The instructions fit. The schedules that support the information fit exactly where they're supposed to be. It's almost like they're actually sort of beautifully designed. I know that's a strange minority opinion.
What's a lovely way to think about it, though, to overcome the terror,
but
I guess.
It's a strange sort of puzzle that you're putting together, and there's a logic to it that unfolds itself as you work on it that I found strangely satisfying.
But you're a money person, though. See, I am not, and I think I would find it more terrifying. So for the emotional side of it, for someone who's not like you are, swimming in the sea of financial literacy every day, what can we do to get over some of those emotional hurdles?
Well, you still have to face the fact that you are a taxpayer and you have to organize information. So if you're doing it for yourself for the first time, you probably are going to want to hire somebody. But I'm still going to say that the tax organizer that somebody should send in advance, which is a long questionnaire of the things that you ought to be thinking about, answering, gathering, documentation that you should bring in, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, there are also programs that you can use, and those are pretty popular. There's a movement that's been lobbied for that the federal government actually has, by the time tax time rolls around, almost all the information it needs to pretty much pre-fill in your tax return for you. But the outfits that do this for a living, including the tax program companies that sell the software, really don't want that to happen. So this could be an easier task if we didn't see that there was certain financial interests involved in just the preparation.
So embrace the taxes, get rid of the terror. What's another good step in just getting a mental handle, an emotional handle on our getting and spending?
Well, certainly getting to know yourself and getting to know something about the way that you find things full of feeling. I'm often struck by the fact that we mistake the feelings about facts for the facts themselves. So when we feel fearful about taxes, it might be that there's a whole coaching or history to, I'm supposed to be afraid of this, this is scary, this is beyond me. There's got to be a whole script that's running through somebody's mind that says, I'm not adequate to this, even when you are perfectly adequate in other ways. So again, focusing on the tax situation, it's a nice little sort of opening into the larger world of financial personality, where the notion that it's a task with pieces, the pieces are doable, evokes this large sort of kind of tornado of emotional feelings that can actually paralyze you from actually taking steps, one step at a time, just pecking at it.
We're talking about money, relationships, and emotions with Connie Kilmark, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
What's the division of labor in your family when it comes to finances? Does one spouse have all the information? One partner just hoping for the best? Well, who's in charge of getting the taxes done, paying the bills, tracking retirement accounts? And how do you share knowledge and responsibility? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with financial counselor Connie Kilmark, looking at our emotional relationship with money and how financial issues work in our relationships.
And you can join the conversation. How do you divide the financial labor in your marriage? If you're a parent, have you worked with your kid of whatever age on understanding these money issues? Or are you dealing with finances for an aging parent? Call and share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Connie, what do you do when you think, or maybe your partner thinks that you're the one who needs to get up to speed, but you're not getting it, you're not tracking, and you're not where either of you want you to be? What's the next best step to stop things from spiraling?
Well, the person who seems to know the most about money may be a person who has an especially analytical sort of Excel spreadsheet kind of brain. And that person will repeatedly explain the information that he or she wants you to know in the same exact way, in the way that makes the most sense to him or her. And that often is the impediment. It isn't necessarily the information. It's the way it's displayed and the way it's arrayed. And that actually can be quite a hurdle. So I would suggest that if there's been conflict or even, and I would hope that this is not the case, contempt that's been developing for the person who seems not to have a knack for gathering or understanding this kind of information, that person not receive instruction from the conflicted spouse or the conflicted partner, because it can be made nerve-wracking. Learning chess or learning bridge from somebody who yells at you or calls you foolish for making a particular bidding mistake will spoil the entire game. So I would say get a second person from the outside who is where the stakes are much lower, and begin to get yourself up to speed so that when you do enter the conversation with the more knowledgeable partner, you have gained some expertise before you start that conversation.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Amy on the line in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. Something that my partner and I have found to be very helpful is that we set up a monthly calendar date on our shared Google calendar, and it's just a dedicated Starbucks and budget discussion. And not just about budget, but about any questions that we might have for each other. In this relationship, he happens to be the person that is more aware of where what everything is going on behind the scenes, And that's new for me. Typically, I had been, you know, taking care of myself and in my former relationship, taking care of the money. So for me to know that that time is coming up on the calendar and it's an opportunity to have maybe random questions that have gone through my mind about money or something that I just don't understand is really helpful. And it also, I think, stops us from having those really quick conversations where we don't get enough information from one another. And we know that this is dedicated time for us to both get on the same page about what's going on.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. What I like about that idea is it's not we have a crisis, we need to talk, but it's a regular gig no matter what's going on.
Well, I think that's crucially important that you make it ordinary and routine. When you only talk about money when you absolutely have to, and then you're unsuccessful, you postpone talking about it the next time even longer because it was painful or it was prickly. And then when you do, there's even more urgency behind it and it becomes unsuccessful again. And so you've developed a vortex of unsuccessful interactions. So what our caller has suggested is make it ordinary, make it routine. Sometimes perhaps nothing but a good cup of coffee is involved in such a nice meeting and maybe nothing of great import comes up. But I love the idea of something routine and ordinary.
Thank you for that call. And Angela in Green Bay sent us an email. She said, I'm in a newish relationship, but we're at different income levels. How do we bridge the gap when it comes to going out and doing things? I feel bad that I can't afford all the things he wants to do, but it also makes me uncomfortable when he pays for too much.
Well, it's a classic challenge to couples when there's a difference in income, and these days it can happen in either direction in a heterosexual couple, and it's always a power differential when there's a differential of income, significant differential of income. In many cases, people will have an hour account, which is where each of you puts proportional amounts of money into the things that will cost, that will benefit each of you similarly, housing, electricity, water bill, those kinds of things. And then have a my account that will allow you each to have some dignity and some autonomy where you're not accounting to each other for those amounts. The person with the more can always invite the other to do something that he, in this case, he will then offer to treat. The person who has somewhat less may choose to offer to suggest something, but then the items would be split 50-50. It's actually rather important that that hour account be split proportionally and not 50-50, because otherwise you really do end up with second-class citizenship in the relationship.
Talking to Connie Kilmark about our money, emotions, getting a handle on our relationship with money. Connie, I had mentioned earlier kids and trying to instill these lessons, this interest, this attention to finances. What recommendations would you have?
Well, know thyself first, because you can't teach what you don't know. We often will try to do on our kids what was done on us, and so we'll attach allowances to chores, or we'll say if you don't earn it, you can't have it. We don't do that with food. You know, as adults, we don't eat unless we work. But as children, we would hope that we're not being told that if you don't do your chores, you can't eat at the table. So I would suggest that money be a lesson that we teach our children by experience. That is to say, we offer them some power, age-appropriate amount of actual spending money, that the money be for a time period that is manageable and understandable to the child, so perhaps a week at a time for a young child. What you're really trying to do is teach gratification and the fact that once some money is spent, it's not going to come back to you. You're trying to teach this to people before they become vulnerable to credit card offers so that they know by the time they can sign a credit card offer that there isn't a free lunch out there waiting for them. So a longer and longer period of time and a little bit more autonomy over time for the child. Also, parents ought not to rub their noses in it when the child makes a mistake and say, I told you so. None of us like to be told, I told you so, ever. Let the actual natural consequences of the choice be the teacher. And ask the child, how did that feel when you didn't have money to go wherever you wanted to go on Saturday? Children can do a pretty good job of self-evaluating if they're doing it in a safe environment where their responses are okay to have.
Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
That's Connie Kilmark, financial counselor, founder of counseling and consulting firm Kilmark Associates, giving us some lessons to help us kick off a federal Money Smart Week.
And you can drop by the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us how you work on the money in your family, with your partner, with your children. Do you have any advice for helping people have healthy relationships, both with money and with each other? Let us know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page.